Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, a program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're on the road again, as they say. Our mobile studio is up and running, and we're very pleased to catch up in it with one of our regulars here at Securing America, usually about this time in the program. His name is Bill Walton. He is the host of his own television program with multiple high-tech studios, I have to say, and I'm an admirer of them and my opportunities to visit with him in them occasionally. And Bill, I always appreciate your visiting with us. You have a background in finance, of course, as well as your work in a number of capacities that have contributed marvelously to, well, philanthropic causes and the conservative movement. And it's a delight to be able to visit with you about some of the pressing matters of our time. Welcome back, sir.
Thanks, Frank. Great to be with you, as always.
Thank you. So, Bill, I've opined that in the wake of Tony Blinken's humiliating performance in Beijing, the latest in a series of humiliating performances, I have to note, it seems increasingly clear that the course we're on now is, well, no longer Pax Americana, the idea of a global order in a fashion largely and benignly dominated by the United States, in favor of what might be called a post-American order, one that the globalists seem to be driving, especially the globalists, as they are fond of saying, with Chinese characteristics. Would you agree?
Oh, I so agree. And, you know, the latest Blinken trip or this Blinken trip to China is just another exhibit A of asymmetric warfare. I mean, we have been eager to reestablish relationships with China after the trip was canceled because China happened to be flying a very powerful spy balloon over the United States. And we've been
a silly calling balloon. As Joe Biden has called it.
What do we call it? Well,
silly balloon.
A silly balloon. Well, Blinken, before he left, so we're not going to be talking about the balloon. Well, here we go. We're hat in hand. We're eager to establish relationships, and we're talking about that we want to de-escalate. We don't want to decouple. We don't want to disengage. We certainly don't want to offend the Chinese in any way. And in the meantime, China issued press release and communique one after another before the trip saying, don't even bother to come unless you're willing to say that Taiwan is part of the greater Chinese state. And, you know, if you want to talk about human rights, that's off the table. If you want to talk about a spy operation in Cuba, that's off the table. And, you know, our leadership, if you want to call it that, is so eager to make a deal with China about climate because they still believe, against all evidence, that China is the biggest single security threat we face.
Climate change, you mean?
Did I say China?
Would that they thought China
would
was
they
the
have thought that?
Like this,
we'd be having a very different and happier conversation.
Right. Well, at least we would be on track with recognizing the realities of our time. But Bill, I guess the key thing about this is, a world dominated by China is not only a very different world than the Pax Americana one, but it's also going to be rather, I think, unpleasant for us, don't you think?
Well, absolutely, Frank. You know, the Chinese totalitarian state under the Communist Party has always been dystopian, but it's getting more so, and it's becoming more and more obvious that President Xi's agenda is not really a worry about consumer welfare or citizens' welfare in China, but to sue his military and global ambitions, and the people to take the hindmost.
Right. And Bill, you know, just to emphasize this point, it's very much the focus, as you know, of our book, The Indictment. He's not interested in his own people's welfare. He's in fact part of a regime that has murdered 100 million of them. And that's without counting the numbers, maybe 400, 500 million in the womb. He's certainly not going to treat ours better. Right?
Well, no, there's not the slightest evidence that they would do so. And I think, you know, we've talked about before, you know, they had their hide and bide strategy where they wanted to hide their true intentions. I think Xi has pulled the wrapper off that strategy, and now we're seeing their naked ambitions. You know, you just look at the way they deal with their so-called Belt and Road Initiative, where they were out lending money to developing countries for infrastructure projects. Well, that was always a not very veiled attempt to get control over those companies, both economically and politically. And, you know, part of the Belt and Road thing is you go into a country and you say to the dictator, gee, wouldn't you like to have a new hydroelectric dam? Oh, and by the way, there'll be a fee for this that will go to you. And oh, you do have an account in Switzerland, don't you? I'd be surprised if you didn't. So anyway, they've now dominated, taken South America, a lot of Central America, Africa, and, you know, Central America and South America, almost every single government, and I can't think of an exception, is controlled by a center-left or even Marxist regime. And China's been a part of that all along. So they're spreading their Marxist ideology, and not even ideology, it's more Marxist practice, totalitarianism wherever they go. They're welcome with open arms by dictators all over the world. This is something.
Again, what does that mean for the people involved? Not so good, I think it's fair to say. And as you mentioned, human rights, the discussion thereof was not supposed to feature in this.
I'm supposed to be watching the economic front here, and it's interesting. They are not interested in pursuing consumer welfare in China at all. And if you look at the growth statistics, number one, their economy is faltering. It's not clear Xi really cares, because economic growth is not his primary aim. But the per capita GDP has been falling for the last 10 years in China. So all these notions that China was going to get richer and the people richer and they're going to become more democratic, that has not happened, and they have no intention of having that happen. They just don't care.
Yeah. You know, Bill, I'm mindful that the mini-me to Xi Jinping, of course, is Kim Jong-un.
Yeah.
And you have an even more extreme example of the indifference to the plight of one's people under that communist regime, where they're starving to death in large numbers, apparently. His military program proceeds apace. I think that basically the same thing is operating in China. Only the trouble is, it's an even bigger military program, and it's partly also a bigger, far bigger economic threat to us as well. Going again to your strong suit. And Bill, as we talk about most weeks, unfortunately, it remains the case, does it not, that American investors, most of them unwittingly, are having their money used to make all this possible. You know, keep the party going, as it were, in China, and keep the Belt and Road Initiative going, and keep the military buildup going, and keep the repression of their people going, and all the rest. And again, the really scary thing about this is, the object of the whole exercise is to dominate the entire world, including us, so we get treated at least in the same manner, if not an awful lot worse.
What's stunning, Frank, is the lack of the media industrial complex refuses to see this and refuses to report on it. Then the reports from the Blinken trip are, oh, this is great because China let us come to visit them. And President Xi gave Tony Blinken 30 minutes. And isn't that a diplomatic achievement? Well, it's not when they're opening spy bases in Cuba, which Biden now claims Trump.
Among a lot else.
Yeah, among a billion other things.
It all started with Trump. Bill, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk with you a bit more about what else the Chinese are doing, in particular in technology, and what that might mean for all of us, because much of that technology, of course, is directly relevant to the military buildup and the threat it poses to us. More with Bill Walton right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The takeaway from Secretary of State Tony Blinken's humiliating visit to Beijing this week, including its seven-hour struggle session with China's top diplomat, is pretty clear. Pax Americana has now been replaced with Post-America. That's the cumulative effect of Obama-Biden's three terms, pursuing the fundamental transformation of the United States of America. The globalists are now in charge, particularly those with Chinese characteristics. They're steadily eroding U.S. sovereignty by the relentless pursuit of so-called global stability, global governance, global health, global digital IDs, and global taxes. Throw in the end of the dollar as the world's reserve currency and the dismantling of our constitutional republic at home, and you have a post-American world. No one has given Joe Biden a mandate to effect such an ominous transformation. The question is, will it become irreversible before he is finally removed from office? This is Frank Affney. We're back, and we're visiting with Bill Walton, one of our regulars here at Securing America, the host of the Bill Walton Show, which you can see, among other places, at CPAC.com. You can find him here each week, and we're very appreciative of that indeed. Bill, I wanted just to pick up on something we sort of begin to touch on in the last block. China's technology programs, the clear intent of Xi Jinping, the dictator of China, is not, as you made very pointedly the case, the betterment of his people. It's securing advantages over us, military in particular advantages over us, in furtherance of their quest for global dominance. And global, by the way, is a key catchword, as I talk about it in the commentary today. It's global health, it's global governance, it's global stability, it's global taxes, on and on. It's the globe according to Xi, I think, is the bottom line. And I guess I just wanted to ask you, Derek Scissors and Dan Blumenthal from the American Enterprise Institute have just written a paper about the sort of priorities that Xi Jinping has for the pursuit of technology, some of it ours, by the way, stolen or otherwise acquired. But what is, as they argue, the agenda for Xi in the technology space specifically?
Well, the gist, and it's important for all of us to understand this, is that, you know, the United States has had tremendous advantages because of a free, open, entrepreneurial society, freely sharing information, and that's the way innovation occurs, and that's why we've had such a lead in all these key technologies. China, on the other hand, has got something they've called socialism with Chinese characteristics, where they've got essentially a state-directed economy, and they've championed industries, and they're doing things like even living data, a factor of production. But the key takeaway is that they're doing what Lenin used to call attempting to control the commanding heights of the economy. And by that, they mean key technologies, whether it's artificial intelligence or other cyber technologies. But essentially, they'd like to control key pieces of the supply chain in other less high tech, but nevertheless important goods like pharmaceuticals, mass use semiconductors, telecom equipment. And they don't have to control the whole industry. As long as they've got a piece of the supply chain, they're in charge. And we saw that back in 2020 when the COVID-19 debacle broke, and we're talking about lockdowns and masks and personal protection equipment. Well, the Chinese weren't so sure at that time whether they were going to send it to us. And that presaged what I think could be a very strategic use of the supply chain. So their economic strategy is not consumer welfare, is not maximization of wealth in society, is controlling these key industries. And it's beginning to work. And they've, you know, the strategy, of course, is they take an industry, they protect a company or a group of companies with price and price controls and subsidies and other things. They put them out into the market to compete internationally with these subsidies in place. They take innovative companies outside China, make deals to take their software either legally or through stealth, and then they end up controlling industries. And it's been working. It hasn't worked everywhere, but it's they're operating from a very different economic playbook than we do.
Yeah. You know, Bill, there's a report that was issued by another think tank, in this case in Australia recently, the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, which talked about the cumulative effect of this sort of fascistic controlling of the heights of the economy in the pursuit of technology advantage. And according to this report, and I'm going from memory, but I think this is right, 37 out of 44 of the advanced technologies of particular interest, if you wish to dominate, you know, the marketplace, yes, but also militarily. And I think some subset of them is something like 19 out of 23 that are directly relevant to the military are dominated by the Chinese Communist Party. So it is working. And I think the key question to me is, and you know, I know the military piece is a passion of yours, but not necessarily an area of expertise. But as you know, Bill, one of the things that has enabled us over decades to have the size of the military that we have relative to potential adversaries is that we have what we call the qualitative edge. It sounds to me as though that qualitative edge is a thing of the past, and that has all kinds of implications, both for our defense spending and budget and investment strategies, as well as the distinct possibility if we're in a war that we will, you know, not have a decisive advantage. We may be decisively defeated as a result. Your thoughts?
Well, I can't comment on precisely how many different industries or technologies they have an edge in. They've certainly been gaining ground and rapidly. You know, we have a lot of secrets in our arsenal that not many people know about. And I don't want to get into classified material, but the impression you got with some, from some of the people working in the Trump administration is we did have some weapons that could be helpful. But that edge is waning under Biden and Lloyd Austin and the rest of the, you know, the Democrat defense establishment. They seem to care less about that than they do about climate. And you know, if you just, you know, as a recovering CEO, you're always setting about trying to figure out what's the one big thing you need to accomplish that's the most important thing that makes everything else irrelevant. Well, in the Biden and the whole administration, the whole global elite seem to be focused on climate as the one big thing, and they're willing to trade everything else in the service of the climate change god. And you know, in return, they're looking the other way when China puts up two new coal plants every week, and the fact that we've become completely dependent on China for our batteries and a lot of the essential things that go into wind and energy. They've lost. If you think we're likely to end up in a kinetic war with China, they're not even remotely behaving in a way that would protect us and defend America.
Yeah. Bill, one other thought. We talked about this last week, and I think the week before, as a matter of fact, as well. One of the gurus of China's acquisition of technology, taking advantage of his position as a preeminent figure in the venture capital space in America, has been this fellow Neil Shen at Sequoia. And to the extent that you've got, you know, this kind of aggressive pursuit of high technology by the Chinese Communist Party, and it's benefiting dramatically from both capital and, you know, insights into the best of American technologies from this fellow Neil Shen, it seems like a really rigged game to me.
Well, Frank, let's understand the culture of the Silicon Valley. Remember, Sequoia was run by three partners, one who runs the U.S. piece and the rest of the world, who's from South Africa. and another man who is from India and ran the Indian piece, and another one, Mr. Chen, as you point out, ran the China piece. And of course, to be effective in China, you've got to have a good relationship with the Chinese Communist Party. And in Chen's case, it seems, I don't have it firsthand, but it seems pretty clear he's a member of the Chinese Communist Party. Now, from an investor standpoint, that's shrewd, because you've got the political authorities smiling on your endeavors. But from a protect the United States standpoint, it's terrible. And Sequoia, as I keep reminding, is just a microcosm or just a piece of the overall issue with venture capital and private equity investing, where the goal for a long time has been to partner with China in all technologies, help them develop it, then of course help create a market where people can make a lot of money from whatever gets developed there. But strategic American interests are not part of the playbook.
Yeah, no, especially when we're up against a guy like Xi who is making that playbook all about defeating us. We have to leave it to that. Bill, thank you as always. Great to visit with you. Come back soon. We'll talk with you next week.
Bye.
We'll be right back with more right after this.
To destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
And a very special welcome to our next guest, a dear friend, as well as a much admired colleague, a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy, among many other things, including the director of jihadwatch.org, a marvelous resource and project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. His name is Robert Spencer. He is, in addition to being the proprietor of one of the great aggregators at jihadwatch.org, both on matters involving jihad, which is a particular area of specialization for Robert, also more broadly, what the left is up to and the common cause that the red-green axis often makes. Robert is also an author of innumerable books, one of the most recent of which is Who Lost Afghanistan? From the Center for Security Policy Press. Another is The Sumter Gambit, about whether the left is now fomenting a new civil war. Robert Spencer, it's great to have you with us. As always, welcome back, sir.
Always good to talk to you, Frank. Thank you.
You had two pieces that caught my eye recently in jihadwatch.org, Robert, and I want to drill down a little bit with you on them. One is the revelation from a seemingly unimpeachable objective source, a Democrat, actually, as I understand it, a professor who has analyzed the vulnerabilities of the Dominion voting machines and established, it seems indisputably, that they are, as has long been charged, vulnerable to hacking or other manipulation. And the question that arises to my mind is, if that's been so for all this time, how is it that we are still hearing people called, election deniers and otherwise, disinforming and in need of censorship for pointing this fact out?
Well, you know, Frank, the 2020 election, it was so questionable in so many ways that it seems clear that the efforts to shut down, discredit, and defame those who questioned it was all part of the process of getting Trump out of the White House and making sure he couldn't return. The fix was in other words, not just in the election machines, but also in the response to people who questioned the election machines. And the whole thing appears increasingly to have been a coordinated, carefully planned effort. And I'm reminded, actually, you may recall that very strange incident in which the CNN commentator, Jeffrey Toobin, was found engaging in an obscene act in the middle of a Zoom call with his colleagues and was removed, although he was reinstated later. Now, the odd thing about that that was never paid any attention to was that this was a call that was devoted to strategizing about coverage of the election. And I thought, wait a minute, why do you need to strategize about coverage of the election? You just report on how the votes fall out one way or the other. But of course, now we know that the whole thing was being elaborately rigged in so many different ways. It seems as if the idea of having to strategize about the election at all, about the coverage of it at all, bears witness to the fact that this was something that was very elaborately planned by a large number of people. And so the Dominion machines are just one part of a much larger whole. And we see that with Fox capitulating and sending $787.5 million to Dominion. Why did they do that if the machines could be fixed, unless Fox was all in on it as well?
Yeah, or certainly didn't want exposure of the kinds of problems that the evidence, I think, if they were doing their job, would show is now been borne out by this report. And exactly. And Robert, I guess the question to you is, you know, it's often said that conspiracies can't be large because, you know, evidence would emerge. Well, evidence has emerged. It seems as though in this case, as you say, that it was a vast conspiracy. And that's not so much a theory any longer. I think it's increasingly now substantiated, whether it's the machines, whether it's the ballot harvesting, whether it's the voter roll manipulations, whether it's the registration, including by, interestingly enough, in swing states, outfits that are directly supported by the Chinese Communist Party. The thing reeks. And the degree to which there has been this incredibly intense effort, clearly in which the media has been complicit to suppress information about anything along these lines. As I say, election denial is the shorthand euphemism for it, but it rots. It not just stinks, it rots. And the question that I guess is before us, and I don't know if you've got any particular insight into it, but I'd welcome your thoughts, is can we reasonably expect there to be a better outcome, a more free and fair election, if we're still relying on Dominion machines and most of the practices that were exploited in that fashion?
Well, very simply, Frank, we can't and we shouldn't. And 2022 was a demonstration of that when all the polls indicated that there was going to be an overwhelming victory for the congressional Republicans. It turned into a trickle and a defeat in many unexpected areas. It was very clear that here again, the fix was in. And so I don't know why people are getting all riled up about 2024 or thinking that we're going to be able to reverse course in 2024 when election integrity has not been addressed and it may not be able to be addressed.
Yeah. Well, it certainly seems as though even in red states, as they're called, there's been a reluctance on the part of a number of state legislatures and governors, secretaries of state to really come to grips with these kinds of realities. I hope that this latest report is going to be essentially the beginning of an irresistible demand for corrections, both with respect to these machines and much more broadly, of course. Robert, we have a couple of minutes left. I wanted to turn to one other issue that you've been covering. Nobody understands, certainly in the non-Muslim world, better than you, jihad. Done more to document it and to describe in particular the forces impelling it within, baked into the DNA, if you will, of Islam's Sharia code. You've noted that many of us are of the view that jihad is over. And you point out, first of all, that's not true, of course, but specifically, it's not over in Africa. Talk about Nigeria and other places where it is very much on the march.
The Islamic State is resurgent, particularly in West Africa and Central Africa. It's also active in Southeast Africa and Mozambique. And Nigeria is really the key place where right now there is a coordinated campaign of ethnic cleansing going on to empty the country of its Christians and to consolidate Islamic control over the entire nation. The ISIS group is active there, as well as other jihad groups, and they have expanded their activities into neighboring countries, notably Cameroon, Burkina Faso, and others as well, even Benin, which has been quiet, not seen jihad before. The idea is to establish a caliphate there. Meanwhile, in the northern regions of Africa, above the Sahara, of course, we already have Islamic majority states. And in Mali, Al-Qaeda is very active to establish an Islamic state there, which would meet up with the one in Nigeria. Then in Somalia, you have Al-Shabaab, which is trying to establish a caliphate in East Africa. In Mozambique, you have another group called Al-Shabaab that is related, that is also trying to establish a caliphate. The various governments of the various states have shown repeatedly that they cannot or will not stand up to these jihad groups. So we could see a caliphate comprising a great majority of the territory of Africa within very few years.
Wow. And just to define that term for us, Robert, it's an historical term, of course, notably in the Islamic Empire's heyday, the Ottomans. But what would the implications of a caliphate in much of Africa be, especially I'm reminded of Donald Trump taking credit for having taken down the Islamic State's caliphate in Syria. If they pick up one of the size and with the resources that you've just described, it would be a whole other kettle of fish, would it not?
Absolutely. The caliph is the successor. That's what the word means. He's the successor of Muhammad as the military, political, and spiritual leader of the Islamic community. And this is very different. It's an Islamic state, but we already have those. When you have the leader of it claiming to be the successor of Muhammad, then that commands more allegiance in Islamic theology among Muslims than an ordinary Islamic state would. And so we saw when ISIS had its caliphate in Iraq and Syria, Muslims, thousands of Muslims from 100 countries around the world went to join it. And the same thing would happen in Africa were it to establish itself there.
Big time. And it would not be confined to Africa. More to the point, the mass murder of Christians that is taking place in, among other places, Nigeria. There's also recently an episode in Uganda that got some attention in the school there. This is likely, it seems to me, to unleash a kind of, migration that we've not seen to this point into Europe and ultimately here from Nigeria, that will be destabilizing in the extreme. Again, not just in Africa, but elsewhere around the world as well. Robert Spencer, thank you for the attention you're paying to these sorts of issues at jihadwatch.org. I commend you for it and look forward to further updates with you. It's vitally important work. Godspeed, my friend, in your work. Be right back with more right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The takeaway from Secretary of State Tony Blinken's humiliating visit to Beijing this week, including its 7-hour struggle session with China's top diplomat, is pretty clear. Pax Americana has now been replaced with Post America. That's the cumulative effect of Obama-Biden's three terms pursuing the fundamental transformation of the United States of America. The globalists are now in charge, particularly those with Chinese characteristics. They're steadily eroding U.S. sovereignty by the relentless pursuit of so-called global stability, global governance, global health, global digital IDs, and global taxes. Throw in the end of the dollar as the world's reserve currency and the dismantling of our constitutional republic at home, and you have a post-American world. No one has given Joe Biden a mandate to effect such an ominous transformation. The question is, will it become irreversible before he is finally removed from office? This is Frank Gaffney. Welcome back, and it's always a very special pleasure to be able to welcome our next guest. Her name is Cheryl Chumley. She is the online editor and a columnist for a very important newspaper in the nation's capital, the Washington Times. She's the author of a number of important books, including Lockdown, The Socialist Plan to Take Down America. Cheryl, it's always good to catch up with you, especially at a time such as this. It seems as though we're being buffeted by increasing challenges, and your perspective on them is something I very much value and appreciate you taking the time to share them with us.
Thank you, Frank. It's always great to be with you.
Thank you. Let me start by asking you a little bit about your takeaway from this recent trip Tony Blinken had in communist China. I'll share with you the thesis that I have, because we've talked about the sort of context for it in the past, and I'd like to sort of update with you. And that is that when you look at what the Chinese communists are doing, and what it seems the Biden administration in the person of Tony Blinken, yes, but also, of course, Joe Biden, are dead set on helping them do, is really taking down our constitutional republic in favor of global governance, as they describe it. And by that, they're talking about global everything, global stability, global health, global digital IDs, global taxes. And I think the point largely is it's instead of a sovereign America. Do you share that concern?
Of course. This is the greatest concern facing Americans nowadays. If you remove the idea of God-given individual liberties in America, which we have, then that opens the door for government to come in and play the God. And now we have, as you just pointed out rightly, Frank, the big global governments with their eyes on America, with aim and design to crumble America's constitution and steal our sovereignty. And they're doing it under guise of national security and for the good and protection. And lately, as we saw under the coronavirus, for the community health of citizens of America and of the world. And the fear here is that the coming generations do not see the peril in this, and they are all too willing to go along with the globalist vision, which is China-like communism for America.
Yeah. There's another piece of this, which I know you're very seized with, and you've written extensively about the war on Christians and the extent to which that is a facet of this kind of Marxist agenda is just further reason to be concerned about the direction this would take our country and its people, is it not?
Yes, and honestly, that is the war. That is the war in America to retain our religious freedoms and our concept of American exceptionalism, which is God-given individual liberties. And as I've said before, maybe even to you on this show, if you take away God from that equation, you cannot have God-given liberties, right? You have to have a thriving, active church faith community taking part in the politics and culture. Otherwise, it becomes corrupted by evil, which look around. This is exactly what's going wrong in America right now. And it opens the door again for government to come in and play the savior.
Yeah. You know, one of the points that I think has to be made in this very context is, of course, the Marxists' agenda more generally of taking down the family, as well as, faith and its practice. These are hardy perennials, of course, of the communists' playbook. And it's, I think, as you say, deeply troubling that it has now penetrated, seemingly, at least in part, thanks to instruments like TikTok, coming generations of Americans who have really been encouraged to believe, or really brainwashed to believe, indoctrinated into believing that the Chinese model is better, is fairer, is the preferred model to that of the United States as well. And I think that you cannot overstate the danger to our society that this is taking root as it has been. Do you see signs that we are awakening to that peril, Cheryl Trimble?
That's a really good question, Frank. And I want to say yes, because I go on media shows and I speak with people like you who hit the nail hard on the head about what ails America. And that gives me optimism that we are openly talking about the link between faith and freedom. But at the same time, I pay attention to the news every day, just like you do. And it's very difficult to maintain an optimistic outlook for the fate of American freedoms, because you look at the next generation and how they're embracing socialism, and they hate founding fathers as racist and capitalism as inherently racist. And you listen to the media, which is the talking parrot for the Democrat Party, which is to say for the Socialist Communist Party masquerading as the Democrat Party. And you think, geez, where is the awakening that we need so badly? I do see some churches waking up and calling on their congregations to get involved with school boards and local elections and politics in general. But the worry here is that it's too little too late, because you see what the globalists are doing, and they care little now for being outed. There was a time where they would be ashamed of being outed, but now they keep on steamrolling their globalism, no matter how many people point fingers and say, hey, that's wrong.
And it is with the force of the state behind them, increasingly in this country. And Cheryl, you've written countless columns on this subject of the extent to which we are now seeing, through censorship, through canceling, through other means of othering, if you will, oppressing people like those you've just talked about, parents, for heaven's sakes, now being described as domestic terrorists as a means of trying to marginalize and, well, suppress them. And it does raise the question of whether it is too late or whether we still have a shot at this. And I appreciate your optimism. We're going to talk a bit about the military of the United States on the other side of this very short break. Are they subjected to these same forces, and to what end? Stay tuned for more with Cheryl Trimble right after this. We're back. We're visiting with one of my favorite guests. Her name is Cheryl Trimble. She is the wickedly smart and extraordinarily principled and always articulate online editor of the Washington Times. You can follow him, her columns there at washingtontimes.com. And also check out her newest book, Lockdown. It's all about the problem that we're talking about here, using health as a vehicle for establishing means of controlling us and doing so in the interest of advancing a global governance, very different from what the founders had in mind and from what has brought us this greatest country on earth. Could we possibly be giving it up as we speak? Well, another aspect of this, Cheryl, that I wanted to visit with you about is what's been going on inside the United States military, the bulwark against so much of the threats we face around the world. We're listening to the sort of, they call it woke. I don't think that's the best term for it. I think it's Marxist sort of cultural revolution taking place inside our country's military. We have a new nominee to become the next chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, a fellow by the name of General Charles C.Q. Brown, who has, as Chief of Staff of the Air Force, been promoting things like, you know, critical race theory, training and indoctrination at the U.S. Air Force Academy and elsewhere, and even quotas for officers in the ranks of the pilots of the Air Force. I think he said that there's the right number is 48% white males. What does this portend if this sort of, as I say, cultural Marxism is allowed to continue to fundamentally transform our military, to use Barack Obama's terms?
Well, in a word, disaster, right? How can a country defend itself if its military is more concerned about quotas based on skin colors than they are about training for actual battle against enemies? And for a very long time now, I would say, mostly under Barack Obama, our military has been used as sort of a testing ground for social justice programs and not so much as the fine fighting force that it's supposed to be. And if you look at what's happening to our military in context of what's going on politically and culturally, and how our country seems to be sold out to China interests now and globalist interests, you have to wonder, if China wanted to ever attack America in some, you know, far world case or far reaching case, what would America do to defend itself if its military is not properly trained to fight? That's where the Second Amendment comes in handy. But of course, this administration is going after the Second Amendment too. So again, in a word, Frank, what's taking place with our military? Disaster for the fate of our nation.
Yeah. I want to come back to that point about this, again, health sort of agenda and some of the implications of it for, among other things, of controlling gun violence, for example. But before I do, just you've written extensively and thought hard about this phenomenon of the sort of transgender agenda. And it's another thing that the U.S. military is being saddled with. It seems as though it is having a very profound effect, not just, I think, on morale and probably on the willingness to serve, but also, the simple retention of people in the ranks. How serious a problem do you think this line of it, I think of it as attack, is just another element of the cultural Marxist takedown of our country?
It is a strategic attack. I think you rightly call that as it is. It's an attack of the left against our military. And look, the soldiers and members of the military who want to fight aren't going to stay in the military and put up with this ridiculous, even evil type agenda. And the ones who are growing up right now in our nation with dreams of joining the military will not join so long as they know that this is the agenda of the military. I can speak anecdotally from firsthand experience. My son, he wanted to be in the military very badly. My daughter wanted to be in the military very badly. under Joe Biden and the shot mandates and the LGBTQ agenda and the wokeness of the military, neither of them want to be in now. Their friends want to get out as soon as they can, even though they had hopes of having careers in the military. And I know this is happening across America to find patriotic families all around. Those who dreamed of joining the military are no longer having those dreams.
Yeah. And the question is, what kind of military will we have at the end of the day if those who are okay with this agenda wind up populating it, at least in some measure? And because it goes back to something you talked about too, what is the impact on our enemies if they perceive us as being not only preoccupied with such nonsense, but also weakened militarily by it? Lastly, just quickly, Cheryl, the Second Amendment you talked about, one of the things that I'm particularly concerned about this sort of global governance agenda is the line that they're taking through the World Health Organization to have Tedros Ghebreyesus, the director general there, dictate our health policy, specifically what constitutes a public health emergency of international concern and what must be done about it. I think it's absolutely predictable that one of the things that he will do, if given such powers, is to decide that gun violence is a public health emergency of international concern, and we must confiscate those guns in order to mitigate it, something the Biden administration would love to do, but can't under the Second Amendment. Should we be concerned about that? 30 seconds.
Yes, we have to keep abreast of what the World Health Organization wants to do regarding our individual liberties, because usually it starts out as talking points and then it filters through Democrat-controlled governments into our politics. And declaring gun violence a health emergency is something Democrats have been quietly stepping toward for a long time. And you're right, the World Health Organization has its eyes on doing the same.
I feel they do. We mustn't let them. And this is where, you know, our sovereignty has to be defended every way we can. Cheryl Chumley, you defend it magnificently at the Washington Times. Thank you for coming by every once in a while and sharing your thoughts with us. You are an inspiration, and we appreciate you so much. Thanks to the rest of you for joining us for this edition of Securing America. I hope you'll do so next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.